Rod Oram is our business commentator. Good morning, Rod.
Marina, Catherine.
So we've got plenty of New Year's, not New Year's, plenty of, that's getting a little bit ahead of things. Plenty of year-end results coming out, company results coming out. Fonterra, there was a general sigh of relief and a pat on the back for the refocused strategy. What did you make of its result?
It was certainly a good operational performance in terms of coming back from a $605 million loss last year, very much driven by big write-offs on bad investments overseas, to a $659 million net profit this year. And at the same time, Fonterra was able to pay down the slightly over $1 billion of debt, which puts it in a much more comfortable position. And it also was able to resume dividends after a two-year hiatus, albeit at a modest 5 cents a share, but opening up the possibility in its forecasts of more in the coming year. The overall question, though, about where is the strategy taking them is not at all clear. What I still really struggle with Fonterra, given that it's our largest company in terms of economic impact, a ship with Fonterra products leaves New Zealand every 3 hours, Fonterra tells us, and all the rest, that this was the year-end results and the presentation by John Monaghan, the outgoing chairman, and Miles Hurrell, the chief executive, lasted only 12 minutes. And then there was about 25 minutes of Q&A. And both the presentation and that the Q&A didn't really flesh out that strategy at all. And indeed, Ari Decker, who's head of research at Jardines, pretty much the largest investment and brokerage house around in New Zealand, has been very critical of that, saying that Fonterra's got to open up a great deal more to explain how this strategy is going to actually create a good deal of value going forward.
So that's the strategy going forward. But when you think of where they were at even a couple of years ago, is it impressive to see the turnaround, you know, compared to what was just a pretty shocking result?
Well, as Decker has said in his report to clients after the results, that basically this represents Fonterra stop doing things that weren't working and concentrating on things that would. And I'm not diminishing that, because that's a big culture change in itself. And indeed, some people, in crucial people, have left the company, the co-op, which has helped. The change in strategy is huge, because it's focusing now in almost entirely on New Zealand milk rather than creating these milk pools overseas, which was an expensive mistake in investment terms. But that's where there is just no description from Fonterra about the capability in the co-op to focus on this and then deliver results. And Decker, I mean, many of us have been saying this for quite a while, but Decker's very articulate on this. I would hope that the co-op would at least listen to him, even if they're not listening to other people making the same comments.
Where is it heading with strategy? You're saying you want to see more of it fleshed out. How has it even outlined it?
Well, it essentially revolves around this idea of New Zealand milk, which is a very good one, but it still does leave some rather orphan assets overseas. Some of those are up for sale, and we know that, but the sales of those are very slow going, and in fact, the value of them has been written down further in these results, particularly China Farms, for example. But another example is DPA Brazil's operation, which was originally a joint venture with Nestle. And a third one is about Chile. So whilst we need to know more about value creation out of New Zealand in terms of products and premiums and the rest, we also need to know about those now rather orphaned assets overseas. On the positive side, in terms of how Fonterra responded to COVID around the world, it was able to be pretty nimble in manufacturing terms. So when, for example, in China, food service and restaurant demand, understandably, pulled back enormously during lockdowns, and sales for home consumption increased significantly. Fonterra was able to shift out of putting milk, for example, into mozzarella for pizza bases, into the likes of yogurt for home consumption. So that's all good, but it's trying to understand where these bigger issues of culture and strategy are going, which is where Fonterra is very inarticulate. And I just have to, I've made the point before when we've discussed Fonterra, when you go to the results presentation of a major company, kind of anywhere else, I'm certainly familiar with the UK and US and Europe, companies go to great length to remind investors what their strategy is, how it's tracking, and actually how it's delivered in the results they're presenting, but then how that feeds into the results that we can expect or their forecasting for the coming year. And so deeply grounding all of their activities in those strategic discussions is a very important part of being a very major company. Obviously, it's important for all companies, but in this context, particularly for a very big one like Fonterra. And that's just not what we're getting from Fonterra.
It's a massive change, though. When you think back 18 months, it had an interim chairman, and it was still waiting to appoint a chief executive. It had been through the travails, shall we put it that way, of the previous years. One wonders if they have just been focused on the financial immediate financial turnaround, as you say. It'll be interesting to see what emerges over the next 12, 24 months. Unfortunately, the next 12, 24 months, the global economy, it's wait and see, isn't it? There's a very wide range being left over the forecast payout, which is, what, understandable at the moment?
Yes, so this season they're just reporting on, the payout to farmers, milk payout, was $7.19 per kilogram of milk solids. And the forecast for this coming year is, or rather the current season they're working on, is unusually large, $5.90 to $6.90, although they're weighting expectations towards the higher end of that. But that's the risk. But of course, this is not necessarily good news for farmers, that the lower milk price lowers the cost of production and therefore theoretically should increase the profits from those products overseas, particularly the ones that are not basic commodities. And then that flows through into the dividend. And so there is upside for farmers if Fonterra can give that get that value creation right from a lower milk price. So that's the sort of issue at stake here.
Let's look at tourism holdings. Of course, it's an industry that's been absolutely smashed, but as is often the case with results, they are backward looking, and have these held up even better than people might have anticipated?
Yes, considering that they had essentially no customers for the last 4 months of the financial year ended June. And so the net profit for that 12 months to June was down 28% to $20 million, which was a few million dollars better off than it was forecasting at the height of that. So it is a very good performance in that sense. One of the intriguing things was that revenues were down only 5%. But one of the reasons for that was they made substantial revenues from selling off quite a few of their camper vans here and in their other operations around the world. And in fact, they've discovered, and particularly here in New Zealand, a greater than expected appetite for ownership of motorhomes. This is a good time to buy because supply is abundant. So that obviously helps. And so and another sign of that was a post-lockdown here in New Zealand, post the first lockdown, they had this campaign, Get Moving to Get New Zealand Moving, and they took 20,000 motorhome bookings here in New Zealand through that marketing campaign, and were very innovative, such as doing little satellite depots for motorhomes, camper vans, in the likes of holiday parks. So if you wanted to go pick up a camper van near you, that's one of the ways you can do it. And they're certainly planning to continue to sell more camper vans. But at the same time, there's some investment in new vans in, for example, the United States.
And are there any other standouts from that report?
No, that's the main one. And certainly Tourism Holdings is a very good example of companies that have been absolutely sideswiped by COVID-19. And of course, tourism is the worst sector of all, particularly one that's very internationally focused like Tourism Holdings. And so it's a testament to their ability to innovate and to be quite agile and resilient to have turned in this performance. So it's a very notable example of what companies can do in very difficult circumstances in this COVID-19 pandemic.
Now, finally, the 50th anniversary of Milton Friedman's famous essay in the New York Times Business Magazine. Was this on the mission, the purpose of business?
It was. And this was an article in September 1970. I probably should have read it at the time, but I didn't. And so I've enjoyed rereading it. And the first anniversary was just the 50th anniversary was just last week. But the context is incredibly important, because although Milton Friedman published his crucial book, Capital and Freedom, in 1962, and it got a fair amount of traction at the time, by 1970, a whole bunch of stuff was in play, particularly in the United States. So I'm just going to run through that. So on January the 1st, 1970, Congress enacted the National Environmental Policy Act, and that brought in environmental reviews of significant economic projects. Then in April of 1970, we had the first Earth Day, when 10% of Americans turned out for some protest or some seminar or some other activity that day. And then in May of that year, General Motors held its AGM, and Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate, had got together a lobbying group called Campaign GM, and various people turned up at the AGM with tame GM lapel buttons on in there, wearing those. And they were demanding the appointment of three directors to represent, quote, the public interest, and to set up a board subcommittee to study the company's performance in areas of public policy such as safety and pollution. Now, shareholders overwhelmingly defeated those motions, although GM did make a nod to them by establishing a public policy committee. But then all the way through the rest of that year, there was further major environmental legislation. Richard Nixon was very active in this and very positive on that, such as the Environmental Protection Agency being founded later in the year and the Clean Air Act being passed. So when Friedman is writing this piece in September, he's really starting to articulate a very big pushback by business against these very pressing issues of safety of products, of environmental issues and the rest, which were really coming to the fore. And so in this piece, he concluded the classic line that there is only one social responsibility for business: to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits, so long as it stays within the rules of the game, which is to say, engages in open and free competition without deception or fraud. So that's how broad he considered the remit of business, and how narrow its responsibilities take on these other areas that were coming so much to the fore.
So 50 years later, are we seeing many people revisiting, and how do you revisit the essay?
A crucial point in direct comparison was in August of last year, when the US Business Roundtable, unrelated to the New Zealand one, other than by agenda, for decades had been the leading champion of Friedman's philosophies. But it caused a stir by announcing its members were updating their position, and they acknowledged their obligations to employees, suppliers and the broader community. And its wrap-up line on that statement was, each of our stakeholders is essential. We commit to deliver value to all of them for the future success of our companies, our communities and our country. Well, I think there's genuine movement, but as a US business academic, Tyler Rye from the University of Pennsylvania, has pointed out recently that many of those companies that signed that document were the first big companies to announce hefty layoffs in the months of the first early months of the COVID-19 pandemic. And but there is real progress. And I'll give you one extremely interesting example with Rio Tinto, the global but UK-based mining company. It's just recently fired its chief executive, its head of iron mining, and its head of public affairs because the company had demolished in Australia an ancient site sacred to Aboriginal people so it could mine more. It turned out that, although this is now being somewhat debated, it actually had government resource consent for that. But even though it possibly had that right to do that, it created such a storm from doing so, that from both public and institutional shareholders, that the Rio Tinto's board fired those three. So that's an example, particularly how of investors have become far more active, far more effective in all this. Now, in New Zealand, the business roundtable here, particularly from the mid-80s onwards, when Roger Kerr took it on and developed it massively, particularly under the sponsorship and support of Doug Myers of Lion Nathan, that was exactly the Friedman-esque approach that the business roundtable and Myers and others took. And the shift here has started earlier than the United States. And I would certainly say that major businesses in New Zealand and on down the scale are now much more attuned to these things. But I think it's important to recognize that these ideas don't go away. They are liable to resurge. But furthermore, for us also to reflect how damaging those ideas were, because the rise of Friedman's views brought about a huge change in US business in the later 1970s, which pushed back against all of that environmental legislation that Richard Nixon put in play. Those fights are still going on, as we see under President Trump, who has been very free and wide-ranging in his wiping out of environmental legislation.
It's that narrow view of what capital is in many ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think those people who promulgate that view need to understand how damaging to their own well-being, their own interests, such a narrow view is.
Thanks very much. Rod Oram, business commentator.